All right. Well, we are turning to Isaiah chapter 5. And we're picking up the story there. All right, so this is a parable of a vineyard that is, although it refers to it as a song, it really is a parable. And as you look down through, you'll see that the justification is kind of centered, which is kind of poetic kind of thing that we find in Hebrew narrative or Hebrew poetry. So it's, let's see, where did it go? We got to get to about chapter 6 before we get out of that kind of justification. Chapter 5 of Isaiah, the parable of the vineyard. And so we read this, verse 1. Let me sing now for my well-beloved, a song of my beloved concerning his vineyard. My well-beloved had a vineyard on a fertile hill, and he dug it all around. He removed its stones and planted it with the choicest vine. And he built a tower in the middle of it, hewed out a wine vat in it, and he expected it to produce good grapes, but it only produced worthless ones. So who's the beloved that's being spoken of there? And who's the vineyard?
Fruit of vines, right?
Okay, so who's the beloved? God. All right. And who's the vineyard?
Us.
Yeah, but in that point in time, it would be Judah, okay, the Jewish nation. All right, so although there is going to be application to us, in a sense, we'll look at that in a bit. So there is this parable about this vineyard. You notice it's been dug all around. So when you read through, it's dug all around, moved stones, planted with choices, vines, built a tower. What's that tell us about this situation? Absolutely. That God had provided everything it needed to be a prosperous and fruitful vineyard. All right? So there's nothing more that could have been done. And so you get down into the last part of verse 2. And he, and I think the editors are correct, at least in my Bible, New American Standard, they have he capitalized. It is, again, referring to God, because that takes us back to my beloved, who is God himself, the Lord, that's being referred to. So he expected it to produce good grapes. You know, it's like there's nothing more that could have been done, but it produced what? Lousy grapes, worthless grapes. And so the question then is asked in verse 5, and now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah. So there again, that gives to us an identification who the vineyard is, in a sense, right? We'll see that. Judge between me and my vineyard. Okay, so here you're going to have a court of law. We want to determine, so whose fault is it that we don't have good crops, that we don't have good grapes that are coming from this vineyard, all right? So that's verse 3. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? Okay, so there helps us identify that this is the Lord's vineyard. He's speaking about it, and he's referring, and we'll see the application. And so the question, what more is there that could have been done? And the answer is?
Planted on good ground.
Nothing. Nothing. There's nothing more that could have been done for this vineyard. What more was there for me to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? Nothing. Why then, when I expected it to produce good grapes, this is the last part of verse 4, I expected it to produce good grapes, did it produce worthless ones? Okay, so, you know, we want to find out what went wrong. The Lord is speaking, I did all of this for my vineyard, and so I want to know, who's responsible for the lack of good grapes? Produced only worthless grapes. Verse 5. So now let me tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. All right, so I'm going to remove its hedge and I will it will be consumed. So in other words, there's nothing more that could have been done. So now comes, in a sense, judgment. All right? There should have been something positive that came from it. It didn't. So it says in verse 5, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to remove the hedge. And when that hedge is removed, what's going to happen?
It's going to be destroyed.
Okay, it's going to be destroyed. So the hedge did what? Provided protection. Exactly. It protected the vineyard. I will break down its walls, and it will be trampled to the ground. So, you know, trampling to the ground kind of has the idea of, like, you know, maybe wild animals are going to come through and destroy it. Okay, so you had the hedge, you had a wall. I will lay it waste, and it will be pruned or hoed, but briars and thorns will come up, and I will also charge the clouds to rain to not rain on it anymore. So God had provided everything he needed for Israel, to be more specific, Judah, Jerusalem. Okay, so we're dealing with those two tribes, the southern kingdom. God says, I did everything that I could have for them in order for them to be prosperous, to have a good life, to have, you know, the fulfillment that God intended them. But they were worthless. And even here it says, you know, not only did God provide protection, fertile ground, dug around it, you know, cultivated all of that, he also provided rain, because we see that in verse 6. So there's nothing more that could have been done. So whose fault is it? What is God is saying? You judge as to why is it that Judah has rebelled against me? Why is it that Judah isn't being spiritually prosperous? It's their fault. And so on to verse 7. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel. There is the identification then. You know, so if you're kind of circling, you can circle verse 7, draw a line back to verse 2, or verse 1, and that defines who the vineyard is. The vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah is the delightful plant. That God had put him there for the flourishing of Judah. Thus he looked for justice. Behold, there was bloodshed. For righteousness, but behold, a cry of distress. So what should have been a prosperous nation was a disaster. All right, keep your place here. Jump over to 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Where, again, the principle, though Isaiah is speaking specifically about Judah, Jerusalem, the two southern tribes, the principle is applicable to you and me. All right? So in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 1, we read this. And working together with him, we also urge you not to receive the grace of God in vain. So who is the him that's being referred to in verse 1?
You God. Said, you said 2 Corinthians 6.
6,
right?
Yeah.
Verse 1.
Verse 1. And working together with him, we also urge you not to receive the grace of God in vain. For he says, at the acceptable time I listened to you, and on the day of salvation I helped you. Behold, now is the acceptable time. Behold, this is the day of salvation. Verse 3, giving no cause for offense in anything, in order that the ministry be not discredited, but in everything, commending ourselves as servants to God in much endurance, in affliction, in hardship, in distress, in beatings, in imprisonments, in tumults, in wet labor, sleepless nights, in hunger, in purity, in knowledge, and in patience, and in kindness, in the Holy Spirit, in genuine love, in the word of truth, in the power of God, by the weapons of righteousness, for the right hand and for the left, by the glory and by dishonor, evil report, and good report, regarded as deceivers and yet true, as unknown yet well known, as dying yet behold we live, as punished yet we not put to death, as sorrowful yet always rejoicing, as poor yet making rich, as having nothing yet possessing all things. I mean, that's quite a statement. So what we see in verse 1 is that we urge you not to receive the grace of God in vain. You see, it's possible then for individuals to receive the grace of God in vain. That it doesn't produce in our lives what God intends for us to produce, to spiritual fruit. And that there are many facets to that. And so, again, God does his part, and we are responsible for our part. And our part isn't always a lot of fun, if you get what the gist of what Paul has just said, right? For he says, at the acceptable time, I listened to you, and on the day of salvation, I helped you. So, actually, that's a quotation from Isaiah 49, verse 8, which we will get there, Lord willing, sometime before the rapture, should that occur, you know, in our time. Behold, now is the acceptable time. This is the day of salvation. Don't keep putting it off. Take advantage of salvation that God has provided in your life. And then Paul goes on saying that as we walk and as we live, we are not to give offense in anything. Oh man, that's a challenge. Yeah. We don't give offense. Now, you know, there are two sides to that. One, we don't do it intentionally, or we do our best not to do it unintentionally. But there are people who are always going to find offense. Especially in our day and in our time, right? You're going to be, you know, if we set our compass by the world and what it says, you know, we're going to, as James says, we're going to be tossed about like a ship. You know, bounced here, bounced there by every wave, doctrine. Every political philosophy that comes down the pike. That's why it's so important for us to have a compass that is true north. And that's what God has given to us here. So we are to do our best at not to provide an offense in anything, to figure out, you know, is this what I ought to say? Is this what I ought not to say in this day and in that culture? And there'll be times we ought to say it, and there'll be times we ought not to. And, you know, it's challenging. And why do we do it? So that in order that the ministry be not discredited, so that the cause of Christ isn't discredited. You know, we almost feel like we're walking on eggshells at times, don't we? In our walk with Christ. I'm not talking about all the other stuff. Just in this walk with Christ, so that we walk in such a way that the cause of Christ isn't dishonored. But yet we live out our faith not in fear or timidity. And that's a tall order. That's a tall order. I had a conversation recently with somebody who is an employee of the public school system. And this individual was saying, you know, we're just really finding it hard to navigate. Because there's something that happened within the particular school that they're telling teachers, etc., don't tell the parents. You know, and they're thinking, you know, it's... But as one who wants to honor Christ and navigate this system, you know, here's the thing. Ultimately, it will come out. It will come out. And we've seen that, you know, down in Loudoun County. Some of those things that were hidden that came out. And I'm reminded of, and I try and keep this in the front of my mind as well. You remember quite a few years ago, Joe Paterno up at Penn State, all right? He wanted to have a football program that was a program of integrity. Well, they come to find out Jerry Sandusky was not a man of integrity. He was an evil person. But in order then to give the illusion or continue on this, he want, you know, I think in his heart he really did want a program of integrity. But the problem was now we have somebody who is not a person of integrity. And so to keep that illusion, we can't tell anybody. And that destroys integrity. You know, that facade, again, I don't think originally he wanted it to be a facade. He wanted it to be real. He wanted that to be his legacy, a program of integrity. But in his attempt to make that the highest standard, he really was dismissed pretty much, right? In disgrace. Because it wasn't a program of integrity. And so I'm reminded of that. And you know, as we seek to walk through life to be people who are honest, you know, that real integrity comes in. You know, most of the time, if somebody comes and says, you know, that happened on my watch, it should not have happened. I'm sorry it happened. We'll look into it. I apologize. That's not where we want it. That's not who we want to be. Most people will grant forgiveness because we all go down there. It's when we're not willing to admit that we've been wrong. I don't know. We just saw recently. I don't remember what state even. I don't know if it was Georgia. It might have been Georgia. That just came out that I think it was sixth graders were taken to this. It was a breakfast kind of thing. There's going to be song and there's going to be dance and whatnot. Well, they took the sixth grade kids to that, and there were drag queens. And so parents are up in arms. Well, the administration is saying, well, we didn't really know, but we don't really think it was bad. And so the state attorney general is now looking into what are we going to do, because we're going to get rid of some of these people. This is not the place for that kind of thing within our school system. Have they said, you know, we didn't check it out as well as we should have, we're sorry? But they weren't sorry. You know, so you give that illusion. And so walking that line, we don't want to discredit, but we need to know where to take the stand and when not to. Man, it, you know, a generation, you know, 50 years ago, we weren't navigating this stuff. And now we are. But we can't be timid, but neither do we become those who, you know, every time something goes off, you know, we got to choose our battles. Well, Paul goes on, but in everything commending ourselves as servants of God. See, that's the bottom line. That I'm serving God. It's not about my agenda. It's about God and his kingdom and such endurance in afflictions and hardships and distresses. I mean, Paul went through a tremendous amount in beatings and imprisonments and tumults and labors and sleepless times and in hunger. And then, you know, so those are some of the negatives that he experienced as he was following God. He was serving God. And then verse 6, in purity and knowledge and patience, in kindness and the Holy Spirit and genuine love, in the word of truth and the power of God by the weapons of righteousness for the right hand and left. You know, it reminds us of Ephesians 6, right? That we're given weapons to fight in by glory and dishonor. Now he gives, you know, polar opposites. Sometimes it's glory and sometimes it's dishonor. Sometimes it's evil report. Sometimes it's good report. Regarded as deceivers, but we want to be true. As unknown, yet well known. As dying, yet we behold. We live as punished, yet not put to death. Though Paul was stoned and left for dead. As sorrowful, yet always rejoicing. Man, that's a hard one. You know, you sorrow with some of the things, and yet we're called to be people of joy. Even in our situation, we don't run around. You know, we're not Eeyore with that cloud hanging over. How you doing? Well, I'm okay. You know, now, I'm not saying we be plastic people. I'm not suggesting that you have to say everything is okay. Yeah, it's really great. I mean, Paul right here is listing some hard things that he went through. In fact, I think it 1 Corinthians, is it 3, where Paul writes, this is phenomenal. God who comforts the depressed comforted me by the coming of Titus. So Paul found himself in a depressing situation, and God sent a people. You know, those that, you know, that somebody come along. So as poor yet making rich, as having nothing yet possessing all things. And so we have a responsibility like the Jews did, Judah, of God providing everything that we need, and the responsibility is ours now. Now, we need wisdom a lot of times how to put that into practice. And James talks about that. Lack wisdom? Ask God. And that doesn't mean that God goes, zap, there it is. You know, sometimes the journey of working through it is as important as the final, you know, destination.
My Bible says in 7, it says that we have faith. At the end of 7, it says we have righteousness as our weapon, both to attack and to defend ourselves.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good rendition. What version? What version are you
reading? I have an NLT.
New Living Translation. Verse 7 of 2 Corinthians 6. Okay? Good? All right. Let's go back to Isaiah. Again, a reminder of 1 Peter 5. God has given to us everything we need for life and godliness. And then Peter writes, but you supply, and he gives 7 things that we are responsible to supply. So God gives us what we need to live life, to flourish, and it's our responsibility then to add. All right, so judgment then is coming because of God's going to take away the hedge, he's going to take away their protection because they didn't repent. That's part of what sin ends up being. It's going to be laid waste. And ultimately, if you remember, you know, that's going to happen here, down here for Judah, when they're taken off to Babylon. Assyria up at the top, 722, they're hauled off, and we'll get there a little bit later in Isaiah. So we come now to verse 8, and there are 6 woes that are given to us in chapter 5. Woe is a statement of judgment, a statement of disaster that's going to come. It's interesting, I think, that there are 6. I don't want to push it too far, but I do think in the Bible there are some aspects, symbolism to numbers. One is a symbol of unity. 3 has the idea of identity, the Trinity, and that kind of thing. 6 is often seen as the number of man. Hence we have 666.
7 is the number of perfection.
7 is a number of perfection. Yeah. So I think there's something to that. And I think here when we work our way through this, as we see the 6 woes, I think that's a reminder, of judgment that's coming on humanity, because especially Judah, because they have left God. They wandered away. And so God, this is part of the judgment that God is bringing, right? Because they didn't follow him, the judgment now is going to come, and hence we have 6 woes. All right, the first woe we find in verse 8. Woe to those who add house to house, join field to field, until there is no more room, so that you may have to live alone in the midst of the land. In my ears the Lord of hosts has sworn, surely many houses shall become desolate, even great and fine ones without occupants. For 10 acres of vineyard will yield only 1 bath of wine, and a homer of seed will yield but an ephah of grain. So what's the...
Getting warm.
She's got a manual fan and a battery operator.
Man, we might have a big one around here somewhere. All right, so how many of you are warm?
It's just her. Don't listen to her.
It's her pause.
How many of you are cold? How many of you are just right? Just right wins. Sorry, Kristen.
I'm prepared for it.
Okay, so verses 8 through 10, what's the problem? What is it that God is judging?
Guilt.
For what?
Greed.
Okay, I think you're right. I think it has to do with the greed. I think it has to do with, you could call it covetousness. There's nothing wrong with owning a house. There's nothing wrong with having property. In fact, if you read through Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, God puts his stamp of approval on the ability to own stuff. In fact, if you steal from somebody, you have to repay them. I mean, that, you know, there's that that's in the Bible. It isn't a matter that it all becomes in everybody's property or whatnot. So it isn't a matter that God is saying there's something wrong with owning houses, but the idea behind it is there's this covetousness, there's this greed, I just to have more and more and more and more. And ultimately to the place, you notice verse 10, 10 acres of vineyard will yield only one bath of wine. They're not getting anything for their vineyard. It's not producing anything because that's part of God's judgment on them because they are covetous. So it produces very, very little. Which prophet is it that speaks about you put your money? It's one of the minor prophets. You put your money, might be Malachi. You put your money in a bag that has holes in it. You know, you put it in and it just seems to disappear. I don't think it's talking about inflation today, but though that seems to be part of the process. Do you need a bigger fan? I don't know.
No, I'm good.
I got one too.
I mean, somebody sit in front of Chris and then.
Grapes or fruit?
Ding. George, why don't you get up and wait? It's your dog.
I know.
Yeah, he's got the weight. So it's the idea of covetousness. We got to have more and more and more. And in fact, it says, you know, they live alone in the middle of the land. They've got all this property. They've got everything, and they're just sitting there all by themselves, and they aren't able to produce much. You know, which is a land that doesn't. Reminder a little bit, isn't it, of Ahab? You remember him? You know, Ahab and Jezebel, where Ahab saw the vineyard and he wanted it, Nabal's vineyard. And in the time in which the scriptures are written, property belonged to certain people, was passed down from generation to generation, and so it belonged in the family line. And you remember that story?
No.
No? Yeah, some of you. Here you go, sprinkle it with water or something?
I don't know how much money's worth.
Okay.
And I was told to put it in a bag. I said, seriously?
Well, you can if there's some in the freezer. Help us out. Bring the big 5-gallon ice bag.
I'm cold over here.
One of them dungeons where you pour in a bucket of water.
What?
I'm cold over here. I mean, I don't know.
Well, I don't think it has. I think there are other things going on. Well, if you remember the story a little bit about Nabal and Ahab, Ahab saw Nabal's vineyard, and it was really a very fruitful vineyard. He wanted it, and he went to buy it from Nabal. Nabal said, I'm not selling because it belongs in the family line. God said that we own it, and so on. And now, Ahab's king. You know, you can trace him out here. Ahab is king. And he goes back home and throws a temper tantrum in front of his wife that Nabal won't sell him this vineyard that he wants. And she kind of says to him, well, you're king. You can take it. Well, he couldn't just take it. So they he got some worthless guys to say that Nabal blasphemed God. So they took Nabal out, stoned him. And then here, this is now your property because you got rid of these individuals and God brought judgment. Part of it came upon Jezebel. If you remember, she died a horrid death. Said that she was not going to be buried, and after there was a transition in the kings, she was ultimately thrown out an upstairs window and kind of splattered on the ground. And the dogs came and licked up her blood. That was prophesied that that's what would happen. She would not be buried, and part of that was because she was a wicked king. Queen, I don't know of anybody who names their daughters Jezebel in a good way.
No.
All right?
Who pushed her out the window?
I don't remember who it was. It was just, it was in this transition from one king to the next, and she was kind of last. Ahab, I think Ahab had already died, and so she was kind of mocking from the upstairs window, and so they pushed her out, and she kind of splattered it.
Don't they claim her spirit still lives?
I don't know if they do or not, but that ain't true. Apply liberally. Good job. There you go. There you go. That should do something. I know we probably are just a tad warmer than what we normally are here this time. So.
Oh, you're fine. It's just me.
All right. So verse 8 is covetousness. Verse 11. What are those who rise early in the morning that may pursue strong drink and stay up late in the evening that they... Wine may inflame them, and their banquets are accompanied by lyre and harp and tambourine and flute and wine, but they do not pay any attention to the deeds of the Lord, nor do they consider the work of his hands. Therefore, my people go into exile for their lack of knowledge. Well, let me just stop there. So what's the woe? What's the judgment in verse 8 through 12?
Drunkenness.
Pardon?
Drunkenness.
Drunkenness, yeah. And if you link that to Ephesians 5, it talks about don't come under the influence of anything, you know, wine. Ephesians says wine, here's drunkenness. But I think we can apply anything that hinders our walk with Christ, that hinders our ability. Don't be drunk with wine, but be filled with the Spirit. So that what is it that is controlling us? I am concerned as I see our... Not only our nation, but even here recently, didn't we just pass something that said cannabis is okay? Yeah. You know, and there are a lot of individuals that are coming under the influence of that, and they're no longer. And if you look at the THD and, you know, CBD and all that stuff, is a whole lot more intense than what it used to be, you know, back in the 70s. And so we're going to see a lot more of those individuals that come under that kind of influence. And I think in a lot of ways it's a gateway drug into the next level. And so we're just opening ourselves up. And so we're no longer under the influence of the Holy Spirit because something is hindering that. And so that's what's here. So on to verse 13. Therefore my people go into exile for their lack of knowledge, and their honorable men are famished. And their multitude is parched with thirst. Therefore, Sheol has enlarged its throat, opened its mouth without measure. In Jerusalem's splendor, her multitude, her den of revelry, and the jubilant within her descend into it. So, what's Sheol? Place of the departed dead, okay? And as we would know it at this point in time, there would be, you know, two compartments. If you remember the story of rich man and Lazarus. One would be like Abraham's bosom, which was a place for the departed dead, but there was also a place of torment to which the rich man went. Okay, Abraham's bosom has been cleansed out when Jesus returned to heaven. That's why when you and I step out of this life, knowing Christ, immediately into the presence of the Lord. That doesn't mean that, you know, whoever was in Abraham's bosom, I mean, God is everywhere present, so it's not like he wasn't, but in the presence of the Lord. So Sheol and Hades, it's a place of the departed dead, but it's also can be a place of torment. And I think here, you know, when it talks, it's just the grave. You know, David talks about that too. You know, when people go there, they can't praise you anymore, etc. So Jerusalem splendor, her multitude are gone. Verse 15, so the common man will be humbled and the man of importance abased. The eyes of the proud also will be abased, but the Lord of hosts will be exalted in judgment. The holy God will show himself holy in righteousness. Lambs will graze as in their pasture. Strangers will eat in the waste places of the wealthy. And so, you know, though it's kind of like this becomes a barren land. So anybody, you know, anybody coming through, vagrants. So that's verse 8 is a woe. Verse 11 is a woe. Verse 18 is our third woe. Woe to those who drag iniquity with the cords of falsehood, as sin as it is with a cart of ropes, who say, let him make speed, let him hasten his work, that we may see it, and let the purpose of the Holy One of Israel draw near. and come to pass that we may know it. Now, that's kind of cryptic, but what's it mean? Verse 18 and 19.
The dragon around their sins and being prideful, arrogant about them.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Continue on. What else is... Pardon? That can be included in there.
Deceiving people to go in a different direction.
And it wears them out. Get worn out. Give in to.
So why do they throw in, like, last part of verse 19, let the purpose of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come to pass that we may know it. Sounds like a taunt, doesn't it? God, come near. We want to... It's daring God to punish them. You know, we're walking away from God. Those who drag iniquity with a falsehood like an ox cart, who say, let him make speed. Okay, hurry up and judge us. Let him hasten his work that we may see it. We don't believe you're going to do anything about it. So this is... It's crazy, but it's what happens when an individual rejects God. You know, we're going to shake our fist in the face of God and say, let's see what you're going to do about it. Hurry up and do something. We used to hear that years ago. Somebody, I forget who it was, made public television. You know, I threatened God and he never did anything and whatever. Yeah, Glenda?
What verse are you reading?
That's 18 and 19 of chapter 5. So it's a taunt. And by the way, we're going to see, you know, hurry up and do it, and we'll see a little bit later on in this chapter where God says, okay, I'm going to hurry up and do it, and you're going to see it. All right, so it's carelessness, deception, pride. Let's go on to verse 20. Those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet, sweet for bitter. What's that say? Okay. We call good evil. And we call evil good. Does that sound at all like where we live today? You know, it's turned upside down. You know, it used to be that in fact, just recently, just saw another. Down at D.C., one of the. Wasn't Air and Space National something? It was one of the museums down there. There were like eight or ten Catholic children who went in there. Pardon?
Smithsonian,
thank you. Smithsonian went in with beanie caps that had the idea of pro-life. You know, we're for life or something of that nature. Just blue, for life. And they were kicked out. Now, this is public museum. You know, private, you can kind of do... And so there's now, well, we're sorry that happened. We're going to do better training. But... Is it Walsh out in West that they're removing all kinds of any prohibition against abortion? In fact, even this if a child is born alive but you meant to abort it, that you can go ahead and put it to death. I mean, it's infanticide. It's crazy. It's a world in which we live. Good is called evil and evil good. You are a bunch of narrow-minded people because you believe this is true, and so you need to get with the program. Just read something interesting. You know, it's people with uteruses, right? I mean, you know, it's no longer, we don't know what a woman is anymore. I mean, we do, but people are having a hard time figuring out. You know, and it's said, we've said that. Biological men cannot give birth. That may be changing. About 10 years ago, there were two women who had uteruses transplanted. And now there are those who are on the trans women, which are biological men who want to be women, are pushing for medicine to be able to transplant a uterus into a male. Now, it's going to be cesarean because you just don't have other parts at work, you know? But there is a push among, you know, it just boggles the mind.
And then I heard on, I watch a lot of reality TV where they have this fake thing about, I didn't know I was pregnant.
Okay.
Don't tell me you can give birth to a full-term baby and not know. Okay, so then the nurse was saying in there, we only have, you know, the women's section, well, we only have commodes for women. And she says, how inconsiderate is that?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm glad I'm sitting there. I mean, it is just...
We know... But it's come to the point where good is being called evil and evil is being called good. Yeah. You know, that's the world in which we live. But God ultimately will bring judgment because it makes, you know, a lot of inconsistencies in the thought process. And so they substitute bitter for sweet. You know, this is going to get us farther down the road. This is what's going to be for... No, it's the result is going to be bitter. It's not going to be sweet. And those are things that you as parents and grandparents, those of us who are grandparents, as we seek to raise our children, need. You know, this is a great passage to come back to and remind them that God's principles for the flourishing of humanity has not changed. And just because somebody says something and said, no, because our kids, your kids, our grandkids, are going to get a lot of pressure, if they haven't, they will, to conform to our world, which is Romans 12, 1 and 2. Don't be conformed to the world around you, but be transformed by the renewing of our mind. That's where it starts. And so they substitute darkness for light. Now you are more enlightened. No, you're more in darkness. It's going to be sweet if you take this. And if you, again, the whole body change kind of thing with especially girls, but even guys, you know, going through the transitions. And, you know, now if your daughter happens to have a little bit of tomboy in her, you know, there's this, well, she's... In fact, this supposedly a medical doctor was being interviewed and said, well, and they asked him, so how young can a person know whether they're really a trans or not? And it's like, well, you know, maybe 1 or 2 years old. In fact, some are saying as early as 4, 5, 6 months.
How are they going to tell you?
I don't know. That's a piece that was missing in the discussion, which are a lot of pieces missing.
There are some signs, though, I think that kind of give them away a little bit. Like even in elementary school, I think sometimes they hold their hand a little, you know, the S stays on there a little longer than usual. You know, it just seems like I sense some of it when just like talking to people, and like some people they're not, you know, it's just like some people they're just really super sensitive. Like a lot of these guys that are like that, they have like dads that are brutal to them.
Well, you know, and looking back, one of our daughters, and it wouldn't take you too hard to figure out which one it was, but started to develop really early, you know, in elementary school. You know who. And in fact, we had to have a conversation with the principal, and they were very good at it. Archie Van Norden, down at Hickory. But there was a boy that was finding it, you know, just had to push on her chest. And it's like, you know, we got a problem here. And so we went in and they handled it well. We were glad. But then I watched, and, you know, I didn't understand it at the time. But then middle school and even more into high school started to wear really baggy sweatshirts. I think, you know, that's what happened here? Well, I think she was trying to hide what was going on. And in our society today, if she was doing that and say, well, you got to bind, you know, you got to wrap the chest really tight, and then maybe she doesn't want to be a woman and she wants to be, you know, it's like, no, she's had a child and she's very happy at being a woman, you know. But that whole scenario, that is, as a parent, given that context, if that was available, I don't know that I would have picked it up soon enough. Now, maybe given as much pressure as we're getting today, maybe, you know, that would have been a little more understandable. It's like, you know, girl, you know, why are you dressing this way, you know? But she didn't run the house, but it's when she would go out, it's like, ah, okay. Now the light bulb goes on, you know. But just some of the things that you face as parents and it you face as grandparents, you know.
Why is it do you think, like, the people, like, even like in Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, even though it was there was a lot of people that weren't doing it, but there was a lot of people that was. But God went in and just destroyed it all. Why do you think God would go in and take away the people that have been obedient? And
there wasn't any.
But there wasn't.
Well, there, what, it went back and forth. He went back and forth with God. He was like, if you find one,
yeah, that's because I remember that part.
Find 10, Satan, because
in there. But there's been other places in the Bible where.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Jason. You know, God gave him the opportunity, and when he left, there were only four of them, and lost one who turned into the pillar of salt. But it's interesting when you know, Lot had moved into the town, and he went to talk to his son-in-laws about God's judgment coming, and the text said that his son-in-laws thought that Lot was joking. Think about that. They apparently had never heard Lot say anything about a relationship with God. And this is who God is. And not until the final moment, it's like, hey, we need to get out of here because judge is kind of fussy. We've never heard you talk this way before. All of a sudden it becomes, and so I think that's, but you know, JD, I think there's a bigger, there's a broader principle to this too. And I don't know how to navigate this one exactly. Okay, but in the context that, and it goes back. I think Belinda, you had mentioned something. You know, we live in a society. The society, even though as it rejects God, we experience some of the God's. I don't know that I'm using your words exactly, but we experience some of God's discipline in our society. You know, as a result, there are things that happen because, you know, and it. It isn't a fact that, you know, we're not trying to turn America into, you know, a quote-unquote Christian nation, all right? That's our calling is for the kingdom of God, but it isn't. This is not Israel. This is not a theocracy. The millennium is later. That will be a theocracy, okay? And so we need to reach people where they are. Rosario Butterfield, who came out of a gay, lesbian background, came to know Jesus, is a pastor's wife down someplace, has some really great books on how to reach individuals caught in the gay lesbian lifestyle thing. But on the other hand, if a nation, a country, society violates God's principles that he's given to us for human flourishing, that will destroy a society. One of the main things that God started when we read in Genesis, the bedrock for human society and foundation is a family. And so when the family gets destroyed, man, woman, you know, male, female, when that get destroyed, there will be consequences. And so Noah's flood, you know, those were individuals who rejected God. Now, again, Noah preached for 100, 120 years. There were only how many? 8. Thank you. Good.
Yes.
Yeah, good guess. There are only 8 of them, you know. That out of that whole mass of humanity, but that was God's judgment on a society that was, everybody was doing, this is from Judges, but the idea is the same. Everybody's doing that which is in their own eyes. So there was judgment. Sodom and Gomorrah, there that affected. You look at the prophets here, and there's a statement of judgment upon those who reject God's principles, even on foreign nations, where there isn't justice, there isn't righteousness, and those kinds of things. So, you know, how to walk that. So we are going to experience.
There was another story, too, in like that. It's in the Bible, too, where where God told somebody to, I forget exactly where it was at, but he told us, if you can go in there and find one good one.
Well, that kind of goes back to what Jason was saying.
Okay, so
he got down, it was 10, wasn't it?
It was 10, yeah. 10. I think it was 10, Abraham and
Lot.
That was in that story?
Yeah.
That was in another one too.
No, where God said to Abraham, I'm going to destroy it. Go tell your nephew. Go tell your nephew Lot to I'm going to bring judgment. And Abraham, I think it starts off 50. You can find 50 righteous, would you spare? Yeah. God says, yeah, if you have 50 righteous, I'll spare. If you can find, and I don't remember exactly, he works his way down to 10. God says, yeah, for 10, I'll spare him. And then they couldn't find 10, and he only had 4, and then ended up with 3. So, yeah. All right, so.
The end of Romans says kind of some of the same stuff when you get into Romans 1:32.
Yeah, right? Romans chapter 1.
Yeah, although they knew the ordinance of God, that those who practice such things were worthy of death, they not only do the same, but also gave hearty approval to those who practice things. You know, so I read that God looks at those that approve of this behavior and things like that could be held accountable.
Yeah, and the difference being approval versus trying to reach somebody for Jesus. And that was the interesting story. You need to read her testimony, Rosario Butterfield. As she was militant, and she was looking for somebody she wanted to write this research paper, but she didn't know any fundamentalists. And so she kind of advertised for that, and there was a pastor and his wife said, hey, we'd love to sit down with you. And they began just having conversation. You know, it wasn't a judgmental thing. It was, let me show you Jesus. And had this conversation. And ultimately, and I think that's where you start. You go back in our presentation of the gospel. We need to start in Genesis 1 before we get to Genesis 3. All right? So Genesis 1 is we were designed, created to have a relationship with God. God loves you. That's, of course, John 3:16. God loves you. And he wants this relationship with you. Genesis 3, but there's a barrier that has happened. It's called sin. And then that's why Jesus came. And then, so that takes us, onto that. But so in our conversations, 30, 40 years ago, you would, and maybe you still do, like Westboro Baptist Church. They're not a Baptist. They're not a church. They might be in Westboro. That might be 1 out of 3. But, they were the ones who held the placards, God hates, and you fill in the blank. John 3:16, for God so loved. And he loves all of us equally. And so Jesus went to the cross for us. And somebody else's sin is not greater than mine. Any sin would separate us from. And so remembering that as we have conversations to help bring someone into a relationship with Christ. And when Rosario Butterfield came to know Christ, she realized there needed to be a life change. And so as a result of that, but one of the things that she found that was so hard, and this is something we need to remember, is that in the gay and lesbian community, it's all about relationship, family, and relationship. When she became a follower of Jesus, that was all cut off. And all of a sudden, she finds herself isolated. And so then to develop new relationships was really, and they would get, that community would get together 2 or 3 times a week, eat at each other's houses and meals and those kinds of things. And that's what she missed when, coming to Christ. She doesn't regret coming to Christ. In fact, one of her books, I think, has to deal with how do we do friendship evangelism, fellowship evangelism, that kind of thing through reaching people. So that, because what is pictured on TV is, as the religious right or whatever that is not what we want to be, bony fingers in somebody's face. But anyway, we need to hurry. We're not going to get the other woes done, We've got to have those. Whoa. Verse 21, woe to those who are wise in their own eyes, clever in their own sight. That's pretty self-explanatory. I don't need any help. I've got it all figured out. Verse 22, woe to those who are heroes and drinking wine, valiant men and mixing strong drink, who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away the rights of the ones who are right. So there's injustice. Okay, so individuals who are in places of position who live and exercise injustice. Again, God speaks very strongly about those who are unjust and speaks about the fact that he is a God who seeks justice. And so we are people who are called to be just in our dealings. And then verse 24, therefore, as the tongue of the city of the dry grass collapses into flame, so their root will become like rot and their blossom will blow away as dust. You know, so you've got a therefore in verse 13. You've got a therefore down in verse 24. They have rejected the law of the Lord, their host, and despised the word of the Lord, the only one of Israel. So that's the problem. They've rejected God's truth. They're wise in their own eyes, taking, calling good evil and evil good. Verse 25, on this account, the anger of the Lord has burned against his people. Israel thought they got a pass. The Lord has burned against his people, and he stretched out his hand against them and struck them down. The mountains quaked. Their corpses lay like refuse in the middle of the street, for all of his anger is not spent. So there's judgment, but God could unload even more. All right? Verse 26. He will also lift up a standard to the distant nation and will whistle for it from the ends of the earth. And behold, it will come swiftly. What is being referred to here, remember they said, you know, God, you're not acting very quickly. God said, I'm whistling for a nation to come and they will bring judgment. All right? So for Judah, it's going to be Babylon that's going to come. I have a standard. I'm whistling for them. I am calling them to come to bring judgment and discipline. Verse 27. No one in it is weary or stumbles. None slumber or sleep. Nor is the belt as a waist undone. Nor is its sandal broken. Its arrows are sharp. This is judgment that's coming. All right. So they're not going to dilly dally. They're not going to waste their time. They're going to come and bring judgment. Looking forward again to Babylon. Arrows are sharp. All its bows are bent. That, you know, if your bow is bent, it means you're getting ready to use it. It's like you're in today's setting would be the gun is cocked and it's loaded. The hoofs of the horses seem like flint and its chariot's wheels are like whirlwind. That speed, they're going to come. It's like a roaring lion and it roars like young lion. It growls, it seizes the prey and it carries it off with no one to deliver it. And it shall growl over it in that day like the roaring of the sea. If one looks to the land, behold, there is darkness and distress, even the light is darkened by its cloud. And so judgment is going to come. Northern kingdom of Israel is going to be taken off into captivity. Assyria, 722. And they disappear, as I've mentioned to you before. They're gone. Southern two tribes, Judah, will be taken off to Babylon. They're in Babylon for 70 years, and then they return. And so that's part of the judgment that is going to come. So God is calling for repentance. He's also calling them for pardon. That goes back to chapter 1, verse 18, which we don't have to. So this aspect that God has given to us, what we need for life and godliness. I think that's a reminder to us. God has given to us truth by which we can live our lives, that we don't have to be caught, you know, bouncing back and forth, what is true, what is error, what is true, what is error. And so we aren't calling good evil and evil good. We have an authoritative book that has stood the test of time. You don't need Bible 3.0, 3.1, you know, or 2023 edition. What God has given to us has stood the test of time. Any other comments, observations? And we kind of leave in a dark spot, and then we get to chapter 6. A great, great passage in chapter 6 where Isaiah, seeing all this horrendous stuff going on around him, is reminded of who God is. And that's so important. That as we live in our day and in our culture and we see all the chaos around us, God is not in heaven wringing his hands. All right? But that's for next week. You want to go ahead and read ahead, you know, spoiler alert, help yourself to Isaiah 6. It's a great, great passage. Comments, questions before we close? Yeah?
What word can I put for, for that Sheol?
Sheol? Yeah. Place of the departed, it's not a word, but place of the departed dead. It's not great. It's like the unseen world, place that departed. Excuse me. Departed dead. This is normally how it's
translated. Heaven or hell?
No. Even Job, if you remember, Lord. No. It was David. Even if I go down into Sheol, you're there. The idea is, if I go up into heaven, you're there. If I take the wings of the morning and fly to the farthest part, you're there. Where can I go from your presence? Nowhere. And that's where he was finding hope. So Sheol is like place of the dead. Although it doesn't mean that it would be soul sleep or somehow he thought he was going to go unconscious. It's just, place of the departed dead. Sheol, Hades, it's really often the same, used interchangeably in the Old Testament. Although, you hear, I forget the author, but, the spot, Hades does get to be a place of torment that will be, just as Sheol ultimately is a place of torment. People who die now go to places who don't know Christ. Not purgatory, but, yeah. Okay, thanks. I hope you cooled down a little. You got your coat on. Okay, then we know we got everybody upset. That's what you want to do.
Well, I was wondering about the salvation of... I've got to get the kids. But, yeah.